two things that I'm going to pass around just before we get on to questions, to give you a little bit of time to welcome us. It costs us money to run head office, so I'm going to pass around a donations box. I'm also going to pass around a mailing list, so if you're new to the party and you'd like to be kept in touch with events, just put your email address and name on the mailing list. Right. Has anyone got any questions or comments or points of discussion? Yep.
Several points, but let's start with the last point you made about alienated Labour. I don't know if you're familiar with Stan Mesheresh, but recently he's been hammering on the point, I think it's very relevant for today, that distinctive capitalist system and the relation of capital to Labour, that's what he got into. And that overthrowing capitalist system does not mean that you have overthrown the reign of capital. And I think the Soviet Union provides the outstanding example of what happens. So that today, when socialist organizations talk about overthrowing capitalist system, if they do not introduce non-alienated labor into the factory, they're just creating the conditions to reproduce this whole cycle all over and over again. So I think this is not just a historical point, this is a point which contemporary socialist organizations must take into account. You must not just be against capitalism. You have to take measures within the... Well, and now the workplace is much more than a factory. I mean, white-collar labor, IT technology labor, now has to consider what part of Marx called the collective labor. It doesn't just mean blue-collar, it means so-called white-collar. This division blue-collar-white-collar is one of the ways of splitting the working class and keeping people from recognizing the identity of their interests. So you have to introduce this idea that alienated labor has to be fought against from the beginning if you're going to really have a successful struggle for socialism.
My answer is that actually reading that, I struggle with books that are 1,000 pages long, like Beyond Capital by Istvan Mazharas. But I mean, I wish he'd written a shorter book to say the same thing. But I agree with you that.
He did write a shorter book. There's a collection of his essays where he makes
right.
that point.
Okay. I didn't get to that one first.
Okay.
Certainly that exactly that point that he makes at some length and very convincingly in there was, you know, for me at the time I was writing this, it was a real, it was a profound insight that I hadn't understood before. And it's, in fact, of course, there are many writers and many strains of socialist thought who had, who did... think about these things in different ways, and I think Mazharas does a really kind of convincing, raises that point in a really convincing way. The question, of course, for today, for which I don't have the answer, is, well, then if you don't do it the way we used to think, which is by having this thing called a worker state, that conception to me really doesn't work anymore, but if you don't do it like that, then how do you do it? And then, of course, there are autonomists who say, well, you kind of build it up, while we're living under capitalism and so on. And then, okay, but then what happens? And, many of them are not entirely clear about then what happens. I mean, to my mind, actually, that much of that is still an open question.
I agree. If we had the answers, we wouldn't be having a meeting of 2030.
We'd be in the
having
park,
thousands
so
of people, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I've got a number of points. Very early in your talk, you talked about the Stalinist repression of the late 30s and what means that as the Bolshevik Revolution. Personally, I see that as a development of the Bolshevik Revolution. Repression actually started as soon as the Bolsheviks were power in October, November 1913, when Chico was set up very, very quickly. And enemies of the state were hunted down almost immediately. I mean, talking about peasants' armies, we didn't refer to him by name, but Makhno in the Ukraine. I was actually a member of the Ukrainian Soviet. Trotsky actually did say it would be better to yield the whole of the Ukraine to Denikin, a Frank counter-revolutionary, than to allow Makhno, especially, have any sort of power in the Ukraine. Emma Goldman said about Khrushchev. Dictatorship on Stalin's rule has become monstrous. That does not, however, lessen the guilt of Leon Trotsky, as one of the actors in the revolutionary drama, Project Construct, was one of the bloodiest scenes. As a defining exactly what the Soviet Union was in, say, 1924. I mean, Lenin himself said in 1920, reality says that state capitalism will be a step forward for us. He actually defines the country, and the new economic policy actually is capitalism run by the state. I know it's a bit big leap, but I will say that Marx wrote in the preface to A Contribution to a Critique of Political Economy, no social order ever perishes for all the productive forces for which there is room in it have developed, and new high relations of production never appear for the material conditions of their existence have matured in the womb of the old society itself. Russia in 1917 does not meet that criteria. Also, 1917 wasn't a socialist revolution. Even Litvinov, I think he was actually in London at the time, he actually admitted it. He said, in seizing the reins of power, the Bolsheviks were obviously playing a game with high stake. Petrograd had shown itself entirely on their side. To what extent would the masses of the proletariat and the peasant army and the rest of the country support them? I think that's about it.
Multiple questions.
Yeah, as you wish.
Alex, did you have a question?
It's about how Lenin, and it's probably the case with Stalin as well, were very much for sort of industrialisation, and they, correct me if I'm wrong, but they seem to want to give more wealth to workers in urban areas and in rural areas. And the fact that that happened, do you think that could be the cause for example, in areas like China, for example, rural workers weren't treated very well, and therefore that led to the opposite extreme, where Chairman Mao got into power to, and even though he killed lots of people, he couldn't say at the same time, but I'm not defending him, but he improved the lives of lots of people in the farms.
Mm-hmm. So one more question.
Yeah. First of all, I'm sorry I missed most of what you had to say, Sam, but I'd get a connection from Clapham Young's on that by mistake. And obviously I've missed a lot of detail of what you had to say. And the first thing that strikes me is to what extent is there any sort of basis today or any fruitful ground for reviewing all these kind of issues, which a lot of what you mentioned there, the detail of it, is very new to me. And is there some, you know, is there a kind of tendency or some sort of agreement
in existence which, you know, we'd be able to develop some of these ideas? In other words, is there possibly a current that, you know, within the working power, within the communist movement generally, which could take forward some of these types of investigations? And also, to what extent, following the development of Stalinism in the Soviet Union, to what extent did the left opposition deal with some of these issues which you could say were previous to Stalinism? And were there any kind of productive conclusions that they made which, you know, at least attempted to deal with, you know, with the issues of Stalinism through resolving some of these problems?
I'll try to, if I don't take up somebody's point, come back to me, but I'll try to. So just starting at the end there, I mean, Andy and I were in a Trotskyist organisation a long time ago together, and, you know, I can see very much where you're coming from. And actually, in the course of doing the research, I mean, I changed my view of the left opposition, not only because in my view, it's completely pointless to sit in the 21st century and kind of judge, you know, people in the 20th century. And I did not set out to judge anybody. But I mean, in my own mind, I kind of formed a bit of a harsher view of those guys than I had before. But also, I had a different appreciation of the facts of the left opposition and how it came about than I had when I was a Trotskyist. And what's noticeable, I mean, when you And, you know, I sat and, you know, sat and read all the... So at the end of 1923, there's this huge internal discussion kind of explodes in the Communist Party, and it's astonishing because this organisation is quite bureaucratised at that time, by that time already, and it's quite kind of formulaic, and it's quite like, OK, we go to the meeting and we pass a resolution, everybody agrees, and all this. And suddenly, whoosh, there's this incredible whoosh of discussion, and literally... And I mentioned the book somewhere. I mean, you kind of get these meetings. The chairman closed the meeting at 4:30 in the morning. I mean, you know, and why is it? Firstly, they've closed down all other political life, really, in the country. So all the political life that's going is inside the Communist Party. So people who are really stubborn and really won't give up and won't just say, oh, well, look, you know, you don't want us to have a left SR group in our factory? Fine, we'll do something else. You know, we'll have a pigeon racing club or whatever. What are we going to do? We're not going to go to jail, right? But the ones who are really stubborn, they join the Communist Party. So you kind of get all sorts of stuff going on, and then there's a disagreement, which is... and the opposition comes up, and it's called the Preobrazhensky-Sapronov opposition, under the two guys who publicly criticised the Central Committee, which was Timofey Sapronov and Yevgeny Preobrazhensky. And it's and Trotsky actually makes his famous statement, which we all read when we were Trotskyists, supporting the opposition, only behind closed doors. And it's only much later that he comes out and publicly identifies himself with this opposition, and on very narrow grounds. I mean, what I was really surprised about is that although I think the Trotskyists developed what obviously, well, to me as a young person and to you and to, you know, thousands of others in thousands of countries, was a very convincing critique of Bolshevism, and, you know, aside from the anarchists, I think internationally you have to say one of the kind of two big critiques going, if you were, you know, if you were involved in the workers' movement from the 1960s and 70s as we were. But that's developed later, right? I mean, in 1923, they're focusing on very kind of narrow, look, you're doing it wrong with the peasants, you should be, you know, pushing industrialization more rapidly, you're not using the levers right, and democracy, but only in a party democracy. Democracy for communists, not for other people. And I mean, in fact, Trotsky, to his shame, actually says quite specifically that the Workers' Truth and Workers' Group, it's the two dissident groups have been kicked out of the Communist Party. He kind of implies in one of his speeches, I've got it, you know, the chapter and verse is all in there, those guys, you know, that of course you have to report those guys to the security officials, which is, you know, he doesn't come out of that looking very good in my eyes. So, you know, doing the book forced me to kind of look again at those issues. So I think what I would say, so that's my answer really, is that the left opposition develops a much more extensive critique much later, and not at this time. About the, you asked about the industrial workers and workers in the countryside, and... I mean, I actually now think, I would have liked to do more about, you know, how much can you do? I spent many years, but I basically focused on those within the cities. But I think the issue of the workers in the countryside, I mean, what's incredible as well is just the sort of, you know, the language which is used by the Bolsheviks, and this kind of goes throughout, I think, communist parties in the 20th century. This is a very kind of clear definition that these people in the city, they're urban workers, and therefore they're with us. These people in the countryside, they're the petty bourgeoisie, so they might be with us, but they might be against us. So you've got built in this kind of hostility to the countryside, and that's and that feeds into the first five-year plan and the, you know, the barbarism and everything. Yeah, go.
And that's another thing. Is sorry, I don't mean to disturb.
No,
sorry. After 1921, they try to, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of farm workers, they somehow they weren't getting a lot of, they didn't receive much for what they were producing. So they managed to persuade Lenin to give them slightly more. And you sort of refer to them as a petty bourgeois. Well, I don't see, I mean, in this country, yeah, farmers do generally own a lot of land and quite wealthy. But I think back in Russia, I don't see how farmers were going to be any more wealthy or sort of any more likely to own a big business than what someone would be in the sort of industrial areas.
Well, in 1917, the peasants who'd previously been working on the land by and large, without owning it, although some own very small parts, basically grabbed the big estates, and this was one of the terrific things that happened in 1917, and it was a fact that the Bolsheviks and everybody else had to deal with. It wasn't done by the Bolsheviks, it was done by the collectives of peasant workers in the countryside. They grabbed the estates. Daryl kindly mentioned at the beginning, I started teaching Russian history to students down at Canterbury, and I mean, I gave them all this piece to read where the peasants actually sit and decide. They go to the manor house, and why destroy such a beautiful house? So then they go away again, and they sit and they have a meeting, and they say, oh no, we remember what happened in 1905, you know, for 3 years after we attacked the landlords, you know, the soldiers, and the state came back at us. So this time it's permanent. And they went back and absolutely deliberately, consciously, you know, and having discussed it in detail, burnt the place to the ground with a very kind of logical approach. And a lot of this happened in 1917, and it was an enormous social change in the Russian countryside. But the issue of whether the land was going to be owned by the peasants, or whether it was going to be owned collectively, or whether it was going to be owned by the state, that wasn't resolved. I mean, it was just kind of left up in the air. And it was only really resolved, I mean, it was very long and complicated, but it was really only resolved in 1929-1930, when it was decreed from on high that the land would be collectivised, and that was done in an incredibly violent and destructive manner. Now, I mean, before that happened, I mean, in the Bolshevik Party of the time I'm talking about, the early 20s, I mean, there were people who passionately cared about this stuff and tried to get the policy right and tried to work things out in the countryside and, you know, spent a lot of time and energy. But, I mean, the logic of the whole thing was towards a forced collectivisation prior to sufficient technology being brought into the countryside. So basically, I mean, the Bolshevik agronomists and technical people and economists all said, look, tractors first, then we'll convince peasants to come into the collective farms, right? And it was done the other way around. When there were still hardly any tractors, the collectivisation was done by force and with terrible, terrible brutality. And a fair amount of that went on in China as well, despite the fact that Mao Zedong actually came to power at the head of a peasant army. And I mean, that actually brings me on, I think, perhaps to the thing you were saying over here, Steve. I think you're arguing that the Stalinist repression was a development of the Bolshevik Revolution. That's not a new argument. So I would say, first of all, that, you know, so on this point, for example, which is the countryside, which is where the vast majority of Russian people lived up until the Second World War or after, I just think 1917 is one thing, and the Bolsheviks is another thing, and 1929 is another thing, and I just don't see that it helps to say that one goes automatically into the other, because, you know, it was far from clear the way things were going to go in 1918. The main respect in which you made that remark was obviously not about the countryside, but about state repression. But I think I would say similar things. I mean, the Bolsheviks were very good at clamping down on people who they disagreed with and who made trouble with them, and people who had influence, particularly among urban workers, who were in a position of power and influence in the new republic. And, I went to a lot of trouble in the book to show how they would pick people out and send them away. What's happening in the 1930s is something different. You know, there's no picking people out. I mean, there's just kind of mass. Well, then, I mean, actually, it starts with the mass deportation of the so-called kulaks, which is peasants who've got a little more land, right? It's mass deportations of whole sections of the population. Now, you know, of course, you know, you can trace the individual biographies of many people who are involved, and I do actually think that Bolshevik ideology and this whole stuff about how we're at war with the petty bourgeoisie in the countryside, I do think that actually, you know, helped to lay the basis for that savagery which you get in 1928 and 29. But I'm not sure, for a historical analysis, we're socialists in the 21st century, we want to look at, what did all this mean and what can we learn from it. It's a very different type of repression. I mean, the numbers of arrests, during in the Civil War period and so on, is low. It's tens of thousands. One is too many, right? I mean, but it's low, and it's kind of targeted, right? And it's in the early 20s that the numbers really start to build up, and then you get this explosion of arrests and of killings, which goes together with this first 5-year plan. So, I mean, I just think they're different processes, and I don't think that in 1918 it was kind of decreed that you were going to end up with 1937. But obviously those are things people have been arguing about in meetings like this for a long time, but that's what I think. And of course, you know, when you say you quoted Marx, and of course that was a, you know, there were people who took exactly that position, and they were the Mensheviks. But the logic of that was that when the provisional government came along, they said, okay, we're going to have a capitalist government, we've got to go through that process, and they tried to participate, and the movement of the revolution left that provisional government completely behind. I mean, the October Revolution didn't happen because Lenin wanted it to happen. The October Revolution happened because those peasants were grabbing those manor houses, and the workers were grabbing the factories, and what was left of the army support for the provisional government just collapsed into a hole in the ground, and it disappeared. I mean, That's why I think there was a revolution in October
1917. Okay. Gentlemen,
there, other question. Yeah, Simon, I just wondered if you've drawn any general conclusions from your researches. I mean, you've detailed them quite clearly, these are the mechanism through which the revolution degenerated. Basically, there's only three general positions on the Russian Revolution. Firstly, that it was a bourgeois revolution from the start, and it continued in a linear, more or less linear process right through to the five-year plans. The second is the one which is held by Lev communists, which is that it could have been socialist revolution if there had been revolution in Germany. As Roosevelt said, that the questions could only be posed in Russia, they couldn't be solved. But there wasn't revolution in Russia, in Germany, so the Russian Revolution inevitably degenerated. And the third position is that the Stalinists and the Trotskyists, that it was a socialist revolution, and socialization of the means of production took place, and it's lasted till 1989.
Right.
I was just wondering if your research has shed any, what your own opinion of this is. I mean, and you know, the whole question focuses back to the April theses. You know, was this complete opportunism? Because was it a misassessment of the world situation that it wasn't, the world was not ripe for a socialist revolution in 1917 because of the predominance of the peasantry worldwide, and this led to a whole lot further extraordinary policies from the Bolsheviks, like supporting the nationalist movement and the colonists. I just wondered if your research has led you to any view on this.
So you said sort of how the deal came about, the oppression, not being involved in politics, but having the living standards improved.
Right.
How long do you feel that deal lasted, and what happened with it? Did it turn into a new deal? Did it turn into just oppression? What? I mean, also maybe linked to that is how do you evaluate that deal? Was it overall some kind of positive deal despite the fact that it had a very repressive government? Was it a negative deal despite the fact that it had improvements in living standards? Would it have been possible without going through a revolution?
Right. I'll take that one first because it's easier than your one. The deal basically lasts until the first five-year plan. So along with the forced collectivization in the countryside, there is the sort of forced march of industrialization and bringing a lot of people into it. So there's a big wave of recruitment of workers into the urban workforce. A lot of women are brought into the workforce. The workforce expands. There's huge investment in big stuff, the steel works and so on. But that also means an incredible increase in the rate of exploitation. So workers have to work harder. There's a decline in real wages in 1928, 29, 30, 31. And a fantastic book on that subject by my very dear friend Don Filzer, the Stalinist workers and the Soviet workers and Stalinist industrialization, where he's done a very thorough study of that period. And somebody also came out of a background as an activist. You say, is it positive or negative? I mean, it, you know, in a way, it's, you know, it depends by which standard you judge. I mean, clearly, workers at the time actually go to meetings and say, and they're very clear about what's happening. They don't think they're participating in the building of socialism. They think that somebody's doing a deal. But yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of workers in times and places, not people like us who come out on a Sunday afternoon and sit in a hot room and discuss these things, but I mean, a lot of workers just think, hey, what's going to be best for my family here? That's sometimes perhaps the main consideration, or even the only consideration for them. And from that point of view, yeah, it's better. Our standard of living is going up. And, you know, people like us, perhaps at the time, okay, let's wait for another day and see how things move and see how the guys in the factory and see things in a year or two's time, and, you know. So that was the kind of mood, I think. It's not for me to say that, you know, they were wrong to make that compromise, and it's hard to see what else they could have done. And then going to the general conclusion, I mean, of course, I've thought a great deal about these questions. I mean, perhaps annoyingly, in terms of actually answering your question, I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned the sort of three general positions, and I came to a sort of none of the above conclusion. I mean, first of all, I have to say that I really, when I was doing the research, I deliberately, like you, evidently from the way you're speaking, have, you know, taken part in 10 million discussions about, you know, the class character of the Soviet state and all that stuff. And I thought, I am not going to write about or research or look at it from that, through that framework. I want to know, what did the people who we didn't hear about think? Right? What did the workers think? Because, you know, maybe that will tell us something. Because you don't generally hear what they think. You hear what Lenin or Trotsky or Bukharin or, you know, whoever thought. Or, you know, the left communists in Germany or whoever, right? And we've had all that stuff. It's been available. What they thought in the factories or what the women thought while they were going to the market was not so available. And you know, I had the privilege of working in the archives and getting to some of that stuff. So I kind of concentrated on that, and I do think that the analyses I mentioned about the technical intelligentsia and so on, I thought that people were really thinking seriously about this at the time, and that was shut down in discussion, which I think is significant. It's none of the above. I mean, clearly, the 1917 revolution clearly goes... in fact, the 1905 revolution, I mean, it goes so far past anything that's happened in the 19th century except for kind of the Paris Commune or whatever. I mean, just in terms of its scale, in terms of mass involvement, you know, there's nothing really like, you know... I mean, you get glimmers of it in 1848, and, of course, that's what keeps Marx and Engels going in their work for many, many years, thinking about that, but... I mean, 1905 was just a civil war on such a scale, and that is overshadowed again by what happens in 1917. This is a truly mass movement. What does it mean to have a bourgeois revolution? I mean, clearly the bourgeoisie was not in control of this thing in any sense. I think I said before, I don't know what it means to call, you know, what emerges, you know, by the end of the 20s, capitalism. I don't know what that word means. Because, you know, what else happens in the first five-year plan is, you know, the market mechanisms have been used during NEP are absolutely suppressed. You get this bizarre kind of structure where those market mechanisms are really kind of pushed down. And, you know, cleverer people than me have spent a lot of time trying to analyse all that stuff, and I'm sure you've read a lot of it. I mean, was the April Theses a misassessment? You see, I mean, I don't, you know, from what I'm saying, obviously, I don't think so. So the April Theses is the thesis that Lenin wrote in April when he said, look, this is not just a bourgeois revolution, we've got to go on to the next stage and so on. But, you know, I actually think that's what millions of peasants were thinking. They didn't articulate it in the same way Lenin articulated, but I mean, I do actually think that's what millions of peasants were thinking. Then you get the Civil War and you get stuck. I obviously don't think it was a socialist revolution. I think this form of property is highly significant. I don't think it lent the state. I don't know what it means. I mean, they did say it lent the state a socialist character, and that was really important to them in the sense of defending what they were doing. But I mean, I don't you know, I don't know what that means from our point of view in the 21st century. I mean, and did I draw general conclusions? Absolutely, yes. You know, I stopped talking about the work of state, which is what I used to talk about when I was younger, because I don't know what that means. And I think it's better not to pretend to have another bullet point if you haven't got one. And I also, you know, I also drew the conclusion, which I, you know, it's, there are people who say, oh, you finally noticed, you should have worked this out years ago. But I mean, many people of my generation didn't. I mean, I don't think that, which is that I don't, that the whole idea of a revolutionary vanguard party really doesn't work for me, which is very relevant to, you know, what's going on now, because I'm politically active, like lots of you probably are. And, you know, it's clear that this group of people who are incredibly dedicated and incredibly serious and incredibly deeply about changing the world, the Bolshevik Party, you know, they get into this, they create this thing, which is what they wanted to do, which is a workers' state, and, you know, forces completely beyond their control are really kind of taking over very, very rapidly. And, but you can see that even as all that's happening, I mean, they stick to this ideology that we know better than the average worker. I mean, they just hang on to that for dear life. You know, they really believe, you know, it, despite quite a bit of evidence to the contrary, that they know a lot better what they're doing than everybody else. And I mean, I think that's incredibly damaging. And I think that actually fed into the whole worker state thing. And, you know, I mean, I've gone into that at kind of length. And yeah, that's obviously a 21st century question in the sense that, you know, when I'm involved in things that are going on, movements, I always sort of think, you know, I want to see more decision-making power going further down and wider. And, you know, I'm a kind of glass half full person. I'm pretty optimistic. I actually think in the age of the internet, you know, that mass democracy stuff is probably a bit easier than it was at the beginning of the 20th century. Not that the internet solves all problems, but, you know, it might be a useful tool.
Down at the front.
Yeah. I think that on this last point, this is where Mesarosh's point of view comes in very helpful. You can have a post-capitalist system which still maintains a capital relation, and if you don't do something to combat that, you're going to regenerate capitalism. Probably most of you have heard the joke about the Soviet system, the longest and most painful road from capitalism to capitalism. Unfortunately, it seems to be true.
Yeah.
But now getting back to a few other points, I think nobody's brought up Rosa Luxemburg's 1905 critique of the Bolshevik Party. She already foresaw where Lenin's democratic centralism was leading. The party was going to take the place of the proletariat, the Central Committee was going to take the place of the party, the Politburo was going to take the place of the Central Committee, and one leader was going to take the place of the Politburo. So, so to speak, the germ was there already in this Leninist structure of the party. And remember, Lenin combated many oppositions and destroyed many oppositions before the revolution. Like materialism and imperial criticism was against a very valid group. He combated them philosophically, but they had a political line different from his, and that was his way of destroying them. And this other question about Marx's approach, you quoted this Critique of the Goethe program, but if you look at his notes on Bakunin's book, you find some very interesting things there. He says there, first of all, he says, yes, you do need a proletariat to have a socialist revolution. Bakunin is wrong. No, not just any oppressed group can lead it, but you need a conscious proletarian group, but it doesn't have to be a majority. And I think you had that kind of a group, certainly in Petrograd, you had a conscious Bolshevik socialist-minded working class. The fact that they survived the July day shows that. There was an attempt to destroy all working class opposition, didn't succeed. They reorganized, regrouped, and carried out the October Revolution. So I think that group was there. But Marx also said something very important there about the peasantry. He said, if this group, the non-majority group, doesn't find a way to do at least as much for the peasantry as the French did in 1789, they're doomed. So the peasant question was a crucial question. If once you took power, you had to have the correct line on the peasantry, you were doomed. And of course, Engels was a point out, you cannot take away the land from the peasantry. You cannot confiscate, you have to let them sit in their land until they're ready to join voluntarily. So mistake after mistake, which Marx and Engels warned against, were made. So I think Marx and Engels had quite a different point of view. You can't blame them for what happened.
On this question of whether Lenin or Bolshevism led to Stalin. Now, I agree with you that there was a turning point in 1928. I mean, the new economic policy had led to a class of net men and small capitalists and rich peasants. And I think Bukharin, in the leadership of the Communist Party, wanted to continue with that, you know, with that policy, but he was outvoted or outmaneuvered or whatever it is. I mean, supposing he had triumphed, what would have happened? It would have been a normal development of capitalism with the Bolshevik Party or a political party in control of political power and a nationalized sector. So it would have been obviously capitalist, I would have thought. But the real historical question, if you like, at that period is why was Bukharin and his followers defeated? And I think, I mean, Kautsky wrote a book at the time, 1920, called Will the Bolshevik Revolution Survive? I mean, everybody was speculating that at some point what's going to happen as these other, as capitalism develops there, is the rule of the Bolshevik Party is going to be overthrown. Presumably Stalin and the people who supported him made the same assessment, and they said, right, if we let this continue, our rule is going to come to an end. So they did decide then, you know, you yourself just said it, they think they know better. And their importance was that we, the Bolshevik Party or the Communist Party, have got to retain political power, you know, come what may. So I mean, I think you could argue that there was some, you know, continuity between Bolshevik ideology or Bolshevik frame of mind, all the way through. But having said that, I agree. You know, Bukharin was also, you know, Bolshevik, and he could have triumphed as, or could he have triumphed? That's the historical question. And what would have happened if he had it? It wouldn't have been, socialist, but it'd been capitalism as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we're playing those sort of counterfactual games, I mean, which, you know, it's good to do sometimes. I mean, I think that any, you know, what regimes apart from Stalin would have withstood the colonization by the Nazis? I mean, that's the question. And, you know, the sort of regime you describe, I don't, you know, had by some very weird kind of turn of events, Bukharin been successful, you kind of think that would not have been the sort of challenge to Hitler that the Stalin setup was, is my kind of counterfactual thing about that. And, you know, obviously these are, you know, we could sort of argue around those sort of points for hours on end. I mean, I suppose my issue with, you know, I just think, you know, Lenin and the Bolsheviks led to Stalin is, to my mind, a sort of, I mean, for a start, it's the, you know, it's the rallying call of the right, which I'm not saying anybody here is associated with or anything else, but I mean, you know, that's part of it. But I think the real problem for the left and the workers' movement, and, you know, I had a lot of friends who anarchists and, you know, who would say such a thing without a second thought. And I mean, I just kind of think it's just not a very convincing analysis of what really happened. I just think life was a lot more complicated.
It's not the anarchists who say that. It's the Socialist Party of Great Britain.
Very good. I now have friends in the Socialist Party of Great Britain who say that. But
pardon me for interrupting, but if Stalin hadn't given the directives to the German Communist Party, Hitler might never have come to power.
Well,
that's also one point Trotsky was right on.
That's also, I think, you know, that's also, yeah, another of those kind of counterfactual stories you can look at, because, yeah, I mean, they split the German workers' movement at the crucial moment.
They supported the Nazis to displace the Social Democratic Party in Prussia, for example.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think there's a lot in those arguments. I just think that, no, I mean, I just, obviously, clearly, and, you know, I mean, one of the things I did when I was doing the research is actually to look at the biographies. A lot of these kind of medium and lower level Bolshevik officials, who, it was a thing, you would regularly kind of write your biography, and it's very easily accessible in the archives, and, you know, it's actually quite kind of, you know, has a narcotic effect on the research. It's incredibly interesting, you know, each person's sort of opportunity to tell a life story. And, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of continuity. That's not an argument for me. And obviously there's these kind of bits of ideology about we know better, and so obviously that will carry through. But nevertheless, I think there are huge, you know, social forces at play which come to bear on that party. And, Yeah, I mean, I just think the authoritarianism and the bullying of 1917 to 18 doesn't automatically, you know, translate into the kind of genocidal dictatorship of the particular kind that you had by the 1930s, I suppose.
Question from Marcus.
It's about the Bolsheviks thinking that they're above workers in general.
Mm-hmm.
Have they never heard of, like, the island Tristan da Cunha? I think in the 19th century, that island, well, it was sort of a leaderless island that worked, basically, just cover people living there. But still, the Soviet Union tried practicing something like that. You know, that's a way in which just showing how the Bolsheviks aren't above the people. So why have they never seen an island like that before?
Anyone else?
Yes, on the issue of Bolsheviks neglecting the working class and the working organisations, which were the Soviets, mainly, I suppose, trade unions were probably independent of that. But to what extent was, what kind of numbers are we talking about regarding the Soviets and their influence within government, their role within government, their role locally, and so on?
Mm-hmm.
And, did it take different orientations, let's say, from the government, and did it continue to take on that role against Stalin?
I'll take the second one first again, because that's on the facts, they're always easier. In Moscow in 1920, because obviously it's different times and places, the majority of industrial workers and the majority of these white-collar workers are A, in unions, and B, represented in some way in Soviets. But, I spent a lot of time researching this Soviet election in early 1921, and, there are factory committees where there's not a Bolshevik majority, and the Bolsheviks are very weak. And I went into huge details. It was a fantastic project run by Maxim Gorky, about who we all know a lot of bad and shameful things he did in his life. But one of the good things he did in his life was he set up this oral history project for workers in the 1930s. And then at some stage, some committee decided it was too controversial to be published, and it was junked. But it was fortunately junked in the archive, and people like me could come along and look at it. And there's a fabulous amount of information from the car factory in Moscow, Anno, which later they produced the Zeals. And there was actually a bunch of American communists who very idealistically said, right, we're going to go and help to build a new society. And they were at this car factory. And an incredible amount of detail about this one place. And these non-party socialists actually got a majority on the factory committee. And that was one place where they were, the Bolsheviks were in a small minority. And the Bolsheviks with the... I sat and used to read this stuff, and I thought, there are great guys on both sides of this dispute, Some of these non-party people, very kind of noble, but, also the Bolsheviks in the factory were fantastic people who'd struggled, who'd been involved in the Red Army, who'd been involved in underground work, before, and great people. And they're fighting each other, and, of course, the Bolsheviks have the support from the centre, right? So gradually you see, even though the non-party people have got a big majority in that, pushed over. So the point about that is that, your question about the influence, after that, so 1921, these non-party people win this majority in the factories, not in the offices, so they don't have a majority on the Soviet, but there's 3,000 delegates, and there's like 1,200 of them or something. They're a big group. And they go to the Bolsheviks meeting, and they say, look, we're prepared to work with you. There's a guy not from that car factory, but from the chemical factory, the Kresny Bogatyr, who's the sort of chairman of this non-party group. They said, look, we want to have proportional representation on the executive. Let's all work together. We've got to build the economy. We've got to get things backed up and running. And, Kamenev, very kind of cynically, who's in charge of the Bolshevik Party in Moscow at this point, just says no, basically. And then there's this kind of long sort of process of trying to edge these people out. And what happens then is that these Soviets just become, like, the real decisions are taken in the party meetings, and then the party members just go to the Soviet meetings and repeat it. And that, of course, how many Soviet jokes have you heard about that? That remains the case, really, right through. So, there's... And what happens, of course, is that as soon as these workers realise that these Soviets are actually just empty talking shops, they're expected to go and listen. There's actually complaints about, we had to listen for 3/4 of an hour to some central committee member making a speech. Well, why? Who decided he should have 3/4 of an hour? etc. And, you know, so then people just leave, right? Actives, people who are outside the Bolshevik Party who've been put onto this thing, they just kind of don't bother going. They've got better things to do. So there's no... So and by the end of this period that I'm looking at, the mid-20s, there's not a lot of independent thinking or talking or resolution writing or activity going on within the Soviet. And you asked about, yeah, the Communist Society you mentioned on Tristan da Cunha, and obviously, yeah, I mean, we know that humanity has lived as hunter-gatherers, as far as we know. All the evidence points to the fact that, you know, for tens of thousands of years lived in communistic types of setup. And, you know, actually, to be fair to the Bolsheviks, I mean, you asked, did they know about this? I think the answer is that, yeah, the ones that had kind of read up on their history and everything, I think, did know about it. And I think they were utterly kind of powerless in the situation they were in. I mean, we've got to remember, well, I've been very critical of the Bolshevik Party here, but I mean, you know, let's just think as well from their point of view. I mean, they're suddenly in charge of this state, and they've got to kind of feed everybody, and they've got to kind of keep the show on the road, and they spend an incredible amount of time and energy doing that. And as I said, I mean, the Moscow Party secretary sort of writes that this thing is just functioning like a pump. All my activists are being pumped out of the factories and into the apparatus. But, I mean, you know, you shoot, and I've got stuff in the book where there was a group of poets who were in the Bolshevik Party, and, you know, they write these beautiful poems about the sort of world they want to see. I mean, they weren't kidding around, these guys. I mean, they were absolutely kind of, you know, they had these ideas. I think, and, I mean, actually, then the Bolshevik Party then starts to rationalise it, and they start to say, right, the first step is building socialism, and that means lots of hard work, and you guys are going to do what you're told. And then, you know, at the far future, that's going to be communism. And in fact, there's a lot of Soviet jokes that if you travel to Russia, you learn. So, you know, there's that the scientists are all feed into one of these old computers, the mass, right? The message comes down from the Kremlin, and they feed into the computer, how long is it going to take to get to socialism? And, you know, the beef, he says, one of these very old computers that fills up a room, and the piece of ticker tape comes out, and they're all, you know, 17 kilometers. Right? What's that? So, you know, they're all sitting around, they have this scientific meeting to discuss, you know, what is this 17 kilometers? And the old caretaker puts his head around the door and he says, I might have the answer for you, comrades. Comrade Brezhnev said that every five-year plan is a step on the way to communism. Sorry, so, you know, it's a number of steps in terms of the clock.
Yeah. 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 So, I know you've got a question. Anyone else spoken? Any comments or points they might like to make?
I first of all want to apologise to Simon for having not read his book.
I'm selling them here, by the way, for money quick, so...
Cool. I don't know intensely what I'm
saying. That's all right. I'm just offering.
I think what's interesting for me, as somebody who studied a lot of Russian history as a graduate, and, like you said, is a former member of a sort of Trotsky sort of had an interesting past, it is just what's coming through with more and more research that is now, you know, being able to be done. I guess a lot of us would only have gone so far in our reading of it until we hit kind of the linguistic barrier, you know, and I don't know any Russian, but particularly now, of course, since the end of the Soviet Union, you've had this expansion of the archives that are available, so I think it's kind of, you know, important that there are people from, well, I'd say, you know, sort of coming more from science position research. I mean, I am a British refugee, or a regional, a couple of years ago. I come to the conclusion, you know, like yourself, maybe in response to the book, and you know, what you're saying is about the only three words of the Russian version, you know, what probably wouldn't really run the lines of Simon, but it's this kind of the above. I mean, I think in a wider sort of sense, what you're seeing is Russian society. It is a kind of society that's in transition during the 20th century. But I would argue it's in transition from feudalism to capitalism. I mean, that would be the main point that I think we can possibly tease out of it. I agree with the gentleman there about the pressing nature of Rosa Luxemburg's critique of Bolshevik organisation as well. And then again, of course, you know, science was saying people found themselves in very hard situations like you always do. In historical reality, you know, I'd say it's pretty well for us to be sitting around 80 years about it and kind of thing. We call counterfactuals, and it's what I call sort of fancy league Russian Revolution. People do fancy league, you know, sort of Spanish Civil War as well, or Spanish, or fancy league English Revolution as well, which is another one. But, you know, it doesn't kind of necessarily always give us a lot of insight. And I think what we can come to now is we can begin to make conclusions that get away maybe from some of the old orthodoxies that we may have heard within the wider you know, Labour movement. I think it's increasingly difficult to maintain positions, you know, political positions. You know, I had 20 years ago, and I'm 22 years ago, recently in Southern UK, for example. So, I mean, anything that helps that process, I think, is incredibly valuable. What I've got from this talk, it reminds me a lot of Robert Service's first book, you know, about the Bolshevik Party. I remember the title of it, Study of Organization and Transition.
And
I always got from that book the germs of future hierarchy and control were definitely, you know, within the Bolshevik Party itself. You know, as you say, it's an absolute tragedy that the idealism and energy of a lot of these people who are in the Bolshevik Party, who I think, you know, to be fair, we're probably sincere believers in, you know, getting to a post-capitalist kind of society was sort of wasted. But, you know, I think hopefully that this has given us a kind of contribution to understanding these processes in maybe a little less dogmatic kind of
nature. I know there are two questions over there. I'm just curious if you want to...
Obviously, the reason we're interested in events like the Russian Revolution is because, isn't it, what can we learn for the future? You know, what Trump has done. You know, really, you look at these high points in the past struggle and what might be potentially revolutionary situation, so that you can imagine, you know, what can we learn from that? What can we sort of transpose anything to any future situation we might find ourselves in? But I think one question that does arise out of this is, and it must have been clear to a lot of people quite early on after the Russian Revolution, particularly when it was obvious that not much was going to happen in Germany or North America, it seemed pretty obvious that they were going to end up in fairly isolated situation, and there was not going to be a worldwide proletarian revolution, by any stretch of the imagination. And so, I think the question then arises, well, supposing some revolutionaries had realised that, what would they try to do?
Should we sort of take the rest of the people and then wind up?
Sorry, yeah.
I don't
want to...
Did you have a question?
Yes, when the Bolsheviks there is more of the three parties, so that they shouldn't have made the more modern than Mensheviks as a socialist
Alex?
It's about, I know you were saying earlier, sorry, the other one of the answers, you were saying earlier about how Bolsheviks, they worked for, well, but they were under lots of stress and stuff, you know, because they're trying to run it from deal with the revolution, start running the country, but that still doesn't excuse them from going into hotels or whatever, actually living anywhere else, like anyone else, because the fact is, everyone would be under lots of stress because we've just gone through a revolution, and that means everyone would have a lot of work to do in what position they're in.
Any final questions? If you can just keep them brief.
Yeah.
I want to come back a bit on what Simon was saying earlier, and what I was saying about the developments of personalism throughout Russia. Lenin himself in 1920, in his speech on economic constructivism, said Soviet social democracy is in no way inconsistent with the rule and dictatorship of one person. The will of the class is at times best realized by a dictator who sometimes will accomplish more by himself than is frequently more needed.
Last question.
Yeah, no, it's appropriate actually, because I have read the book. No, I think it's a good book. So I don't. How much did you say you're selling it for?
£20.
£20. If you could reduce the price, you might make.
Well,
anyway, seriously, it's a good book.
it is too expensive. So going from the last point, there are lots of kind of horrible quotes by Lenin of the type that you mentioned, and he says those things, and he clearly, there's a lot of stuff about, we'll arrest so-and-so, we'll kill so-and-so, we'll go into a village and kill as many people as we have to. And, it's barbaric stuff. And, I'm certainly not, I don't think it's defensible. I mean, actually, again, the point is, you often get these discussions among 21st century socialists about should the Bolsheviks have done this, that, and the other, and quite honestly, they're not going to ask our opinion, and they didn't at the time, and it doesn't matter what we think. What matters what we think is about now, and the danger with that stuff is it kind of gets into this kind of, you go on a demonstration in like 2012, and there are suddenly people who are kind of, marshalling you. And what's in their heads is, Lenin marshalled people, so we can marshal people on this demo.
Mm-hmm.
And so my practical conclusion would be to tell those people to take a running jump. I think that's the importance of this stuff, is that it got into the whole, it's deep in the traditions of the 20th century movements of a lot of different kinds, of labor movements, of nationalist movements and so on, and then of course what you get with Maoism and then the quasi kind of so-called communist nationalist movements is you get an incredible kind of violence, and
Cambodia being the worst example.
Well, Cambodia being the worst example. I mean, to come closer to home, I had a long correspondence many years ago with a prisoner in Ireland who, quite a few actually, but I mean one particular guy. And the discussion kind of ended because, he read extensively about history and had a lot of time, he was in jail. But, the kind of discussion ended with the guy just couldn't get away from the idea that, the gun is at the centre. And I sort of said, look, okay, we're going to just, please send me any more questions you've got about literature. I can't make it more difficult than it is already, but I think, that's kind of us done with the discussion in a sense, because we just couldn't get past that point, and so I think that's it's the way in which this stuff kind of has fed into the ideology of the movement that I think is truly the most damaging sort of legacy, that this is somehow okay to have these sort of barbaric attitudes. And just to be clear, what you say about, I included all that stuff about the people living in hotels and in the book precisely because I feel exactly the way you do. It's not an excuse. And Lenin's very clear. He says, look, we're all working here 18 hours a day, and we're kind of more important because we're keeping the country going. And he sort of justifies that as a reason why the Kremlin. That was somebody who went to Lenin and said, look, what's this about the Kremlin canteen? It's incredibly well supplied compared to every other canteen in Moscow. And that's his answer. And no, I don't think it's right. And I think, that's a problem. Because there's this horrible shortage, which, thank God, for me, in my life, I've never had to live through. But, I like to think that were I in such a situation, I would kind of try to maintain my kind of egalitarian sort of beliefs. And... I'm not at all. What I do mean is that it is absolutely true that with this sucking process and these young, very devoted people who really believe they were doing everything they could to change the world, they do get sucked into these administrative jobs, and then suddenly they're administering some factory, and suddenly the workers are on strike, and they got to decide what to do. And some manager who's still there from the Tsarist time says, "Oh, just sack them," and they just sack them. So they end up doing things that they themselves probably a few years before would have regarded as being criminal. That is what happened. That's all I'm saying. Andy asked if there had been communists there who saw that. You're absolutely right. And of course, they did realize, but. That's kind of like to quote an example which people in this room may actually remember, and I certainly do. When you get to the miners go on strike in the spring of 1984, it's only really clear that the whole TUC thing is never going to happen. It's only really clear by kind of September, I think, when the TUC Congress takes place, and they couldn't have been further from deciding anything to do anything to support the miners. But it's not really clear until that point that actually, and you know, then you're already on a different kind of, you know.
I suppose the point I want to make, I think, you know, there are situations where you realise that you are going to be defeated.
Yeah.
And have to think about retreating in good order. I mean, what I'm saying is that is that what you always get in that situation is rhetoric with people saying, oh, we're going to fight to the last drop of blood, you know. But actually, that's just suicide. and you do have to have some kind of way of saying, okay, we're not actually going to get what we want. So.
The one thing you don't do is call it socialism.
Right.
Which means that the Western working class say, this is socialism, we don't want any more of that. We're still paying for that.
Yeah. Well, that is clearly part of the answer. But, I mean, I'd go back to the miners' strike, and I'd say that, you know, in the my friends in the miners' union were very clear that the strike should continue and remain so until, like, February of 1985. And, I mean, I can't actually to this day think that I particularly disagree with them. Although I think clearly there was going to be some kind of defeat. I mean, in that case, it was like hold out as far as we can in order to lessen the kind of impact of that defeat, I think. But,
I think the miners' strike was something, in a way, the miners did start to talk about how we're going to, you know, retreating with dignity and stuff like that. I remember miners saying things like that.
Well, you see, in this Bolshevik case, I mean, the retreat is 1921. And, you know, Lenin's very clear that this is a retreat. And all the Bolshevik leaders are very kind of, look, we're retreating. We're making this deal with the peasantry. And actually, it's the left of the Bolshevik party that really kind of can't handle that at all. So I'm not saying, and I'm not going to say what side I would have been on in that dispute, because that would be so completely stupid. But, I mean, it's just to kind of show you the complexity. And thank you very much.
Thank you.